As a matter of fact, it is the last lecture on our regular series. Our speaker this evening is a native of Victoria, British Columbia. He's one of these rare people who are actually born in this province. And he went to school there, and after taking his schooling, went into the Royal Canadian Air Force, where he had a distinguished record overseas. On his return from service, he entered Queen's University, where he was a student of political science. He obtained his Bachelor of Arts degree there and his Master of Arts degree in 1948 and 49. Shortly thereafter, he received a Beaver Club scholarship and proceeded to study economics at Cambridge University. And it is from that university in England that he received his doctor's degree. In 1953, he joined the staff of Yale University, and he had a distinguished career there, being one of the youngest professors to attain the rank of an associate professorship at that institution. It is there that the president of our institution, the university, heard of him and invited him to join our staff, which he did last year, to succeed John Deutsch as head of the Department of Political Science and Economics. He is an author in the field of economics and political science, and was invited by the Gordon Commission, by the chairman, Mr. Gordon, for the Royal Commission, to do a study called Canadian Commercial Policy, which was put into a book and which was presented to the commission as another view on a analysis of our economic situation at that time. This evening, he will speak to us on the subject of Canada's trade and your prosperity, Dr. John Young.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Those of us who return to British Columbia are often called upon to speak very frequently. And by this time of year, we're very fortunate if we can dig anything out of the hopper that we haven't already said. So I apologize to any in the audience to whom some of these remarks might seem a little familiar. I'm going to begin by assuming that everyone agrees that Canada's trade and our prosperity are closely linked, and go on to discuss ways in which changes in the international economy may have an effect on Canada's trade. The developed part of the international economy, with which we do most of our trade, has gone through some striking changes in recent years. A few years ago, Canada and the United States were the successful, prosperous, and secure countries who were attempting through aid, advice, and leadership to help Europe and Japan back to their feet. In the last few years, things have certainly changed. Europe has been setting the pace in trading arrangements, with one development following upon the heels of another, while the United States has been doing little, and we have been retreating from a freer trading world. Europe and Japan have been more than balancing their accounts with the rest of the world, and both Canadians and Americans have been worried about their balance of payments situation. Europe and Japan have been booming, and North America has barely dragged itself out of one recession before it has slid into another. Now, there is enough of a Puritan streak, I think, in all of us that we rather enjoy being told that we have brought this on ourselves by not working hard enough or by asking for too much. It is generally true that at any time, most of us can benefit from the advice that we ought to pull up our socks and work harder. Thus, it is almost always safe when discussing economic matters to tell people that if they work harder, they will be better off, and if they are more thrifty, they will accumulate more wealth. On occasion, however, economies get involved in difficult situations, which are rather complicated. And advice of this kind, which may be good as far as it goes, needs to be supplemented by some thinking of a rather technical kind on the alternatives which are open to us. Now, I referred at the outset to three distinctions between our recent experience on this continent and that of Europe and Japan. The first being the difference in our recent tariff history, the second, the differing payments positions of this continent and other parts of the developed world, And the third, the difference in the level of economic activity and employment between ourselves, Europe, and Japan. Now, since this paper deals with international economic changes and their effect on Canada, I shall only deal with the third issue, that is, of unemployment, insofar as it is related to our balance of payments. Now, I'd like to begin by discussing the recent changes in European trading arrangements and their likely effect on us. By now, everyone is probably familiar with the general nature of the inner six and outer seven and the possibility of a merger between the two, and I will merely sketch in the background briefly. In June 1955, the six, that is France, Germany, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, stated their intention to make a fresh start towards economic integration. At the time, most people were skeptical. It is true that these six countries had managed to reach an agreement on a coal and steel community, but the European defense idea had failed, and there seemed to be little prospect of success for the new venture. This skepticism is understandable. Who would have thought that such a short time after the end of World War II, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands would have been prepared to form an association with two former enemy countries, Germany and Italy, which had the effect of discriminating against their former ally, the United Kingdom? It is small wonder that many were taken by surprise, not least the British themselves, who then and later failed to appreciate the strong drive to integration existing on the continent. Now, the formation of a common market posed a problem for other European countries. For almost 10 years, all the European countries had been working together in the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, that is, the OEEC. And the new arrangement among the six meant a split within Europe, within a Europe which had grown accustomed to a measure of solidarity. Before the Rome Treaty was signed, the United Kingdom government put forward proposals for a European free trade area embracing the six and the other members of the OEEC. Now, the details of this are only of historical interest, but the basic idea was the elimination of tariffs on industrial goods among all OEEC countries, but the retention of the common external tariff of the six against the rest of the world and the retention of the individual tariffs of the other countries. The Treaty of Rome had provided for a common agricultural policy, while the British proposals excluded agricultural commodities and foodstuffs from the negotiations. The counter proposal of the six was close to an invitation to join the common market and accept the common agricultural policy and a common external tariff. Now, these negotiations broke down. The exclusion of agriculture and a number of technical difficulties played a part, but more important, there was a reluctance, particularly on the part of France, to take on additional problems of external competition, and also a feeling that the British and others were attempting to gain the economic benefits of association without accepting some of the implicit obligations to closer political integration which could be read into the Treaty of Rome. Once the negotiations had failed, the British were left with a difficult choice. They could go back and try again, they could do nothing and wait for a more favorable opportunity, or they could gather up the pieces and hope that the increased bargaining strength enjoyed by an association among all the excluded European countries would help to secure an accommodation with the common market. The third possibility was the one selected, and the result was the formation of the European Free Trade Association, incorporating that strange assortment of countries, the United Kingdom, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Portugal, Austria, and Switzerland, the so-called Outer Seven. Now, these changes were bound to be viewed with some concern by Canada. In recent years, the countries of the European Economic Community, that is, the Common Market, or the Six, these are all interchangeable terms, have taken around 8.5% of our exports, while just over 15% of our exports have gone to Britain and another 3% to other members of the European Free Trade Association. Thus, more than a quarter of our trade might be affected. The Canadian response to the common market proposal was a fairly cautious one. It was pointed out that while Canada welcomed the scheme, the Canadian attitude would be much influenced over the years by the shape taken by the trading arrangements. We were inhibited then, as we have been inhibited ever since, by our unwillingness to take any new initiative in tariff policy. This was clearly indicated when a British proposal for a free trade area between our two countries was rejected out of hand. This proposal, which in itself held little attraction for Canada as a terminal arrangement, might well have been thought worthy of more extended examination as an opening wedge into the European developments. Having turned down the British ourselves, we were in no position to complain when they attempted to secure an accommodation with the six for themselves and other members of the OEEC. Similarly, when these negotiations broke down, there were no grounds on which we could criticize the British for taking the step of forming the Free Trade Association. It is only in recent months when the likelihood of a British accommodation with the six on a basis much closer to the original continental proposal that there has been a sharp reaction. And our Minister of Finance has warned that if our preferential position in the United Kingdom market is significantly impaired, the pressures for Canada, and here I quote, the pressures for Canada to embark on closer trade associations with other countries, particularly with the United States, would understandably be greatly increased. Well, now, we've seen what has happened and what we have done, or perhaps more accurately, not done about it, and can now turn to the likely effect on our economy. This can be done first by looking at the general effect which customs unions and free trade areas can be expected to have on outside countries, and then turning to the effect the European arrangements are likely to have on specific Canadian exports. Let me first state the general theory in highly simplified terms. If a number of countries with separate tariffs form a customs union, which has a common external tariff, which in some sense, and this sense has to be vague, is equal to the average level of the preceding individual tariffs, then two influences are brought to bear on trade. Some new trade which did not exist before is created by the removal of barriers among the member countries. These barriers fall to zero within the common market, so that Germany's tariff on Dutch goods is to be zero and Italy's tariffs on French goods is to be zero. So that the new trade is created by the removal of barriers within the customs union. Now, individual industries in member countries will have to go through an adjustment process, and some individual hardship may result. But over the long run, this new trade will be beneficial to member countries without any damage to other countries. It is new trade. Some trade, however, which formerly existed between individual member countries and outside countries, will be diverted. Sellers outside the customs union will now have to compete with sellers inside who have the advantage of free entry, while outside countries have to contend with the common external tariff. For example, if Canada sells a good to France in competition with Germany, then if the common external tariff of the common market on this particular good happens to be 10%, then our German competitors are able to enter the French market without a tariff, while we have to face a 10% tariff. And so some trade which had existed before between individual member countries of the customs union and this country will now be diverted to a source within the common market. That means that outside countries, therefore, are not faced with a very promising prospect. The new trade which is created will largely be created among member countries, and the trade which is diverted will be diverted from outside countries. On the face of it, you do not apparently gain on the swings what you lose on the roundabouts if you are not a member of the club. Now, if this were the only change which took place as a result of a customs union, then outside countries, losing from trade diversion and gaining little, if anything, from trade creation, could expect to be losers on balance. It would be possible to find a common external tariff which was low enough to permit as much trade creation between member and non-member countries as would be required to compensate outside countries for their losses from trade diversion. It has been assumed, however, and this is a fairly safe assumption today, that the common external tariff is not lower than the individual tariffs it replaced, and in the absence of other effects, this will not be low enough to offset the losses of outside countries. This suggests a certain loss for outside countries. Yet there are some, particularly those in the inside countries, who argue that outside countries can expect to obtain economic gain from a common market. Their general line of argument is a simple one. The formation of a common market, according to this view, will lead to a higher rate of economic growth for the member countries. The rise in the demand for imports resulting from this enhanced growth will more than offset the decline arising from discriminatory tariff adjustments, and both inside and outside countries will be better off than they would have been in the absence of the change. The increased economic growth is expected to arise mainly from the increase in the scale of market and the gains in productive efficiency brought about by exposure to competition. Now, it's always difficult to strike a balance in a particular case between the forces making for reduced trade for outside countries and the forces making for higher income and thus higher external trade for the members of a common market. Now, very little change is required in the above analysis when it's applied to a free trade area. Since a free trade area leaves individual members' tariffs against the outside world unchanged, no problems arise in attempting to establish a common tariff of the same average level as the preceding individual tariffs. For the rest, however, the general effect working through trade creation and trade diversion is similar. Outside countries can expect through trade diversion to lose part of their markets to competitors inside the area and may or may not benefit from the creation of trade which occurs among the member countries. As before, any net losses arising from tariff discrimination may be offset by greater economic growth and thus a higher demand for imports. If anything, the factors working for increased economic growth will be less rather than more powerful in a free trade area, since the degree of economic integration is less. In general, therefore, there is no more reason to suppose that outside countries will gain from a free trade area than there was to expect them to gain from a common market. Thus, the outside country's evaluation of the trade effects of either a free trade area or a common market rests on the comparison of two magnitudes, neither of which can be ascertained with any degree of accuracy. We do not know with any precision how much trade will be diverted, and we do not know how much general expansion will occur to provide an offset to that diversion. Now, much of the writings of professional students on this subject suggest very limited gains in economic growth for associations of this kind, and therefore the likelihood of adverse effects on outside countries. We have some evidence in this country which throws some light on the issue. We know from an analysis of our own situation that if we were to form a free trade area with the United States, the gain to this economy from an expansion in the size of its market by 15 times would in all probability not exceed a 10% increase in our real per capita income. The changes brought about in the Canadian economy by an arrangement of this kind would probably be more fundamental and far-reaching than those likely to result from most common markets and free trade areas. Thus, the gain in net external trade would likely be less than the net reduction in imports and exports resulting from diversion. And there seems little doubt that some of the countries exporting to us, like Britain and Western Europe, would suffer a fall in their sales to Canada. Our situation would, therefore, suggest that unless the forces at work in Europe are different from those at work here, outside countries might expect to lose on balance. Now, this may be too narrow a view of the issue. It's always dangerous to reason by analogy, and there may well be important differences in the imponderable factors. There is no question that the objective of a common market has had an effect on the outlook of European leaders in business, labor, and government. While it would be wrong to attribute the recent European boom to the first steps towards the formation of the European Economic Community, the provision of an objective and a program to achieve it has no doubt contributed to a sense of confidence and high morale, which may have been a significant stimulus. Thus, even when looking at these new experiments from a purely commercial point of view, we cannot conclude that outside countries will necessarily lose. Now, even if it were true that outside countries as a whole were to lose some trade as a result of this, this need not be the case for any individual country. Each country selling to Europe is supplying a different basket of goods, and some will fare a good deal better than others. On the face of it, sellers of primary goods like ourselves might expect to do rather better than countries which sell manufactured goods to Europe. Given the limited supply of raw materials in Europe, it might seem that we have little to fear from trade diversion and something to hope from such expansion of their economies as occurs as a result of trade creation and other effects favorable to economic growth. In fact, our situation is rather less favorable than general reasoning might suggest. As far as our sales to the EEC are concerned, that is the six, agricultural products alone make up just under 50%, and industrial raw materials over 40% of our principal exports in 1959. Thus, over 90% of our principal exports to the six are primary products which we might expect to be treated fairly well in a customs union among a number of industrial countries. Unfortunately, we have less reason to be optimistic. We have had a team of negotiators in Geneva for some months, and at last report, things did not look very promising. The six intend to develop a common agricultural policy with a common price for wheat and other agricultural commodities in which we have an interest. The farm price of wheat in Germany is high, while the price of wheat in France is considerably lower. If the common agricultural policy yields a price of wheat in Europe, which is anything approximating the German price, this will provide a stimulus for wheat production in France, and we stand to see a market for around $100 million worth of Canadian wheat seriously endangered. Most of Canada's sales of industrial raw materials to the EEC are concentrated in minerals and metals, and in general, the conditions of entry are favorable. Asbestos, copper, nickel, and iron ore enjoy free entry. Lead and zinc have rates of 0.75 per pound, but the incidence of these rates is reduced by tariff-free quotas. Aluminum is the main source of concern in this sector, the common external tariff being 10%, while formerly Canada had free entry into Benelux and a 7% German rate with a large duty-free quota. When European producers, and perhaps more important in the long run, producers in the associated territories in Africa, have a 10% advantage over Canadian sources of aluminum, some part or all of this growing market might be lost. In 1960, our aluminum sales to the SIX totaled just over 20% of all Canadian aluminum exports. Now, while the Canadian government has been somewhat concerned about the effect the common market will have on our sales to Europe, the possibility that Britain and the rest of the European Free Trade Association might enter into an arrangement with the EEC led to a much sharper reaction than any similar event of recent years. In part, this reflects the importance of the United Kingdom as a market for Canadian exports. In recent years, 750 to 800 million of our exports go to the United Kingdom as compared with 300 to 400 million for the six EEC countries combined. Canada's principal exports to Britain as to the EEC countries are agricultural commodities and industrial raw materials. Wheat alone usually adds up to about 20% of all exports, followed by aluminum, newsprint, copper, nickel, etc. Canada enjoys free entry or a preferential position on exports to the United Kingdom. The introduction of the European Free Trade Association leaves all British tariff rates unchanged as far as we are concerned, but over time will permit six new countries to share in the free entry. On some items, it will create reverse preferences by giving members of the outer seven more favorable entry than that enjoyed by Canada and other Commonwealth countries. The United Kingdom has already granted concessions to Denmark and Norway on bacon and frozen fish, respectively, while in the field of wooden paper products, other than newsprint, the Scandinavian countries will have an improved competitive position in the British market. This is mildly disturbing to Canadians, but has not been regarded as posing a serious threat to our trade with the United Kingdom. On the other hand, if the United Kingdom and other members of the Seven enter into an arrangement with the common market, then it seems quite likely that the terms of any such arrangement will pose a serious threat to Canadian trade. If, for example, the common external tariff rates on aluminum, wood pulp, lead, and zinc were extended to the UK, or some compromise solution were developed, an adverse effect on Canadian trade in these products might result. Perhaps more important would be the extension of some variant of the common market agricultural policy to the United Kingdom. With EEC agricultural policy in its present unsettled state, it's difficult to know how serious this would be. It is clear, however, that if the United Kingdom, to any significant degree, meshed its agricultural policy with that of the rest of Europe, this might well have a significant effect on the sale of some Canadian agricultural products. The prospects, therefore, are not as bright as we might hope. It would be misleading, however, to suggest that these European arrangements pose a prime threat to our prosperity. If the worst comes to the worst from our point of view, and we find some of our markets for primary commodities significantly reduced, we can live with the results. This province and other regions like it will be less prosperous, but the country is not going to be led down the road to ruin. Some of us who have argued that this country should have responded in a more positive way to the new initiatives forthcoming in Europe have placed a good deal of our emphasis on political as well as economic considerations. If the British succeed in reaching an agreement with the Six, we shall no doubt begin to get something of a feeling that we are marooned on this continent with the United States. We may then begin to feel that we have one of two choices, either closer bilateral economic relations with the United States, which, as we noted earlier, the Minister of Finance put forward as a possible escape from such a situation, or a retreat within ourselves a view being put forcefully in other high quarters. Both alternatives pose significant political and economic problems for this country, and there is something to be said for making a serious attempt to avoid being faced with such a dilemma. Now I would like to turn to a discussion of the North American payments position. Both Canada and the United States are often said to have payments problems, and it has sometimes been suggested that the underlying cause of both is essentially the same. According to this view, North America has become a high-cost area of production in the world, and the balance payments position of the two countries reflect this fact. Now, this is a hypothesis which deserves careful examination, since our domestic difficulties are often said to have arisen because we have priced ourselves out of world markets. Now, I shall begin with the United States payments position, since if we're going to wait for renewed American prosperity to float us out of our existing unemployment problem, their success or failure in combining domestic economic expansion with an acceptable payments position will be a major factor in the success or failure of the short-term outlook in this economy. The United States began to run a deficit in its balance of payments more than 10 years ago, following the devaluation of the pound, and with the exception of two brief intervals, has run a deficit ever since. Over the last 3 years, moreover, the deficit increased from a 1951-57 average of around $1 billion to an average over the last 3 years of $3.7 billion. During this period, therefore, the United States was on balance buying, giving, and lending more than it was selling and receiving. And as a result, countries outside the United States were able to add to their holdings of dollars or draw gold from the U.S. gold stock. Between 1951 and 57, the United States gold stock remained virtually unchanged, while the dollar holdings of other countries increased from just over $8 billion at the end of 1950 to just under $15 billion at the end of 1957. From the end of 1957 to the end of 1960, other countries gained gold from the United States to the extent of just under $5 billion, while the other foreign countries' dollar holdings rose by almost $6.5 billion. Now, as a result of these and other transactions, the United States gold stock fell from just under $23 billion to $17.5 billion. And of this total of $17.5 billion, $11.5 billion was held as a legal reserve for Federal Reserve currency and deposits. Now, in 1957, before anyone talked about the United States deficit, when other countries' dollar holdings were around $15 billion and the U.S. gold stock around $23 billion, some students of international finance pointed to the closing gap between quick assets and short-term liabilities and predicted that if dollar liabilities continued to grow while the gold stock remained constant, a liquidity problem might arise in the future. That is, the United States might not be able to meet without embarrassment a demand for gold by holders of dollars. At that time, however, books and papers were still appearing explaining the inevitable continuance of dollar shortage. And when in 1957 there was a flow of gold into the United States as a result of the aftermath of the Suez Crisis, this was heralded by some as an indication of a return to the difficult times of the early post-war years. Even those who had always argued that Europe and other countries could and would solve their payments problem with the dollar area found it difficult to make the mental leap to the position that the United States would have difficulty in solving its payments problem. Now, it's convenient for present purposes to distinguish between two types of balance of payments deficits. One can be described as a flow deficit, and the other a stock deficit. For a country on a fixed exchange rate, a flow deficit can arise if it gets out of step with at least some of the major trading countries. In short, either its level of employment or its level of cost and prices, or some other circumstances, put its domestic producers at a disadvantage relative to foreign producers. And if this happens under what can be regarded as a normal level of transactions, unaffected by strikes and droughts and special circumstances, then we can talk of that country as suffering from a flow deficit. Now, if a country has a flow deficit, there's no reason that that deficit should be temporary. On the contrary, if it's not merely a result of special circumstances, a flow deficit will tend to continue as long as the underlying income and exchange rate or relative cost and price situation remains unchanged. It is quite possible, therefore, for a country such as the United States, which has a fixed exchange rate, to price itself out of world markets, although, as we shall see, it's an open question whether, in fact, this has happened. On the other hand, a stock deficit may be defined as a deficit arising from a switch of assets. In particular, the switch from the short-term liabilities of one country to those of another in search of higher returns, greater security, or speculative gains. A stock deficit is an essentially temporary phenomenon. Once relative levels of short-term interest rates have changed, or the hope of speculative gain or the fear of loss has passed, the stock deficit will tend to be corrected. Now, stock deficits played a significant part in the recurring sterling payments crises during the early post-war years. Relaxation of restrictions often led to the accumulation of inventories of materials. This, in turn, led to payments difficulties, increased import restrictions, and a resulting decumulation of inventories. Moreover, the United Kingdom, as a reserve country, also from time to time was faced with embarrassingly large short-term capital withdrawals. That is, people turning pounds into gold and dollars, or pounds into marks. If the gold and dollar reserves of the sterling area had been sufficiently large, these stock deficits might well have been handled without significant changes in interest rates, income, prices, or exchange rates. The United Kingdom, however, was for some years so close to or involved in a flow deficit that it was not possible for it to accumulate a sufficiently large reserve to handle significant asset switches. Now, in one sense, a stock deficit gives less cause for concern than a flow deficit. Fundamental changes may not be required, and if reserves are adequate and other conditions favorable, the storm can be weathered without difficulty. There is a sense, however, in which a stock deficit is more dangerous than a flow deficit. Under normal circumstances, a flow deficit does not burst upon the scene dramatically, but gradually builds up to a level which, if prolonged, will pose a significant problem. There is usually time for changes to be introduced gradually. A stock deficit, on the other hand, often develops very rapidly, and if there is freedom of movement of short-term capital, can assume large dimensions. The latter has often been regarded as a measure of the possible demand on the gold stock, and this is both an overstatement and an understatement of the potential demand. Only official holders of short-term liabilities, that is, foreign governments and central banks, have a technical right to convert dollars into gold. And since they require some working balances, only a portion of the outstanding short-term liabilities constitute a direct immediate threat to the gold stock. If, however, private holders of dollars, whether Americans or foreigners, develop the view that the dollar is likely to be devalued, then the potential demand against the gold stock could be vastly greater than the existing total of short-term liabilities in the hands of other countries. Now, the evidence suggests that the 1960 deficit in the United States balance of payments was in large measure a stock deficit. But the deficits of 1958 and 59, which we referred to earlier, do not fall readily into this category. So we have a mixed picture. In his recent message to the Congress, President Kennedy suggested that steps should be taken to deal with both the short-term and the long-term problem. To handle the short-term problem, changes were suggested which would encourage foreign governments and central banks to hold dollars, and it was announced that efforts would be made to collaborate more closely with other major countries to take care of the international flow of short-term capital. Some of the long-term measures proposed are probably familiar to you. It was recommended that returning American travelers have their customs exemptions reduced from $500 to $100, some limits be placed on expenditure abroad by military personnel, and more preference be given to U.S. sources for all types of procurement. These measures amount to an increase of U.S. trade restrictions. The export promotion and other programs were recommended to reduce restrictions and discrimination against U.S. exports. On the whole, the suggested program appears to be based either on an optimistic appraisal of likely future developments or on the belief that the underlying strength of the American position is so great that any drastic change at this time would be premature. There is some evidence to support both these views. Part of the deficits of the years 1958 and 59 can be accounted for by special circumstances, including the different timing of European and American recoveries, the abnormally large inflow of automobiles, the steel strike, the temporary lull in cotton exports, and a number of other factors. It could be argued that taking the whole of the experience of the last 3 years, there are some grounds for thinking that the diminished flow deficit of 1960 heralds a return to the normal levels of 1951 and 1957. Now, if this does not turn out to be the case, and for the present the evidence does not appear to provide any clear answer one way or the other, there is enough strength in the American position to permit a further period of waiting until a clearer picture emerges. Indeed, it might well be asked whether there is not a degree of optical illusion in the American deficit itself. During most of the years in which the United States has been described as running a deficit, a substantial improvement has been recorded in its net capital position vis-a-vis the rest of the world, offset in part by a decline in the gold stock. What has been happening, therefore, is that the United States has been lending long, that is, accumulating long-term assets abroad, borrowing short, that is, providing other countries with short-term liabilities in New York, and giving up part of its gold stock. Thus, when looked at in the widest perspective, this apparent long-term flow deficit tends to look rather like a special type of stock deficit, which may find a solution when other countries reduce their demand for additional gold and dollar holdings or are able to satisfy their thirst for reserves in some other way. In short, a country which has been running a surplus when current transactions and unilateral transfers are taken together and still has a gold stock of over $17 billion has some distance to fall before it can be described as being in severe difficulties. Now, the Canadian payments problem, if it can be described as a payments problem, is almost the reverse of that of the United States. The United States has experienced a net accumulation of foreign assets since 1950, but has had a worsening reserve position. Canada, on the other hand, has had an almost continuous net accumulation of foreign liabilities since 1950, but has had no significant reduction in its official reserves over the period as a whole. During recent years, the Canadian exchange rate, which since 1950 has been free to respond to persistent trends in either direction, has been at a premium with respect to the US dollar. Or I should say since 1952, it began to move in that direction in 1950. Since 1952, however, the last year in which Canada ran a surplus in its trade on goods and services with the rest of the world, the Canadian current account position has altered from a surplus of over $350 million to a deficit which since 1956 has run from $1.1 to $1.5 billion. A deficit of this size led to a good deal of comment and concern during boom years such as 1956, and this has tended to intensify with the continuation of the deficit into the current years of unemployment and diminished growth. Now, several differing interpretations have been offered of the Canadian payments position. Some seem to hold the view that the flow of long-term capital and the current account deficit are essentially independent phenomena, which by a fortunate coincidence happen to balance. They are like the elderly lady who once remarked how clever it was of filling station operators to put their pumps just where the gas happened to be. Others have leaned towards the view that the current account balance is the autonomous factor and the capital account adjusts to it. This is a view that Keynes once put forward about 30 years ago and is a view that is still held by some economists. Still others, and this group would probably embrace most Canadian economists, hold the reverse view that in Canada's case, the balance of trade in goods and services in recent years has adjusted to the long-term capital inflow. This is not to deny that independent changes can take place and have taken place in the current account balance with consequential effects on short-term capital movements, but it does assert that the main line of causation runs from the capital flow to the current account. That is, from the capital flow to our balance on the sales of goods and services to foreign countries and the purchase of goods and services. Goods and services including physical goods and exports and imports and the so-called invisibles, that is, travel expenditure, freight and shipping, interest and dividends, and others. Now, it's never easy to draw a sharp distinction between long and short-term capital movements, but the general pattern seems fairly clear. A sharp increase in long-term capital inflow occurred in 1950 and 51, and from 1951 to 55, the level was between 550 and 650 million. Beginning in 1956, the level roughly doubled, and during the period 56 to 59 is between 1 and 1.3 billion. In 1960, the long-term capital inflow fell below a billion. Now, in the years after 1952, the current account adjusted fairly smoothly to the long-term capital inflow. This was not the case during the period 1950-52, in which there were many cross-currents which influenced the international accounts. Briefly, what happened was that during the first three quarters of 1950, the United States dollar in Canada stood at a premium of 10.5%, and there was a large-scale flow of short-term capital into Canada in anticipation of an appreciation of the Canadian dollar. The rate was freed on September the 30th, and on October the 2nd, the market opened with the sale of United States dollars at a premium of 7%. Well, this rate continued to decline during the remainder of 50, 51, and 52, reaching an average discount in 1952 of 4%, and ending in December at a discount of 3%. Thus, from September 50 to September 52, the United States dollar in Canada moved from a premium of 10.5% to a discount of 4%. The same time in 1952, there was a major decline in the world prices of many of Canada's imports, and this was reflected in a big improvement in our terms of trade, that is, in the price of our imports relative to our exports, a reversal of the current account deficits of 50-51, and then a significant outflow of short-term capital, which had come in to take advantage of the possibility of appreciation, it took its profits and left. From 1953 to the present, the adjustment mechanism has worked a good deal more smoothly. In 1953 and 54, the current account deficit lagged behind the capital inflow, but this was reversed in 1955, with a current account deficit exceeding the long-term capital inflow by a narrow margin from 1956 to 58, and by a wider margin in 59 and 60. Now, the question of whether the capital flow determines the trade balance, or whether the trade balance determines the capital flow, is of more than academic interest. Those who regard the current account, that is, the good in the trade in goods and services, as a largely autonomous element, are inclined to harbor fears over the consequences of any significant reduction in the capital inflow. Where, they ask, are the export and import competing goods and services to come from if the capital flow tails off? This line of argument is reinforced by the particular form taken by the current account deficit. In 1951, the merchandise deficit was 147 million, and the deficit on non-merchandise transactions, the so-called invisibles, was 370 million. Between 1951 and 60, the deficit on the so-called invisible items has increased from 370 million to 1,120 million, while the deficit on merchandise trade in 1960 was still 148 million. In other words, the entire growth of 750 million in the current account deficit between 1951 and 60 has taken place in the non-merchandise group, which includes gold production for export, travel expenditure, interest and dividends, freight and shipping, and a number of miscellaneous items. The increase in the deficit on non-merchandise account has been rapid, persistent, and apparently deeply set into the structure of Canada's trade relations with the rest of the world. How, it is asked, is a change in the rate of capital inflow going to reverse this tendency, and where, if no reversal takes place in this sector of the accounts, can a merchandise surplus of the required dimensions be found? Now, this is not an easy question to answer. It can, of course, be asserted that if the export and import competing goods and services are not forthcoming, the exchange rate will move until they are forthcoming. Let me repeat that, because it's a point that I think should be grasped. We have a flexible exchange rate. If we are unable to balance unless we operate in the exchange market, that is, unless we use our exchange funds to influence the rate, then that rate is established by the demand and supply for our foreign exchange. If, therefore, the capital flow were to cease, or to tail off or to become limited in size or even to be reduced significantly, then there would be a consequential change in our exchange rate and a consequential change in our trade. And if that change in our trade were not adequate, the exchange rate would keep moving until it was adequate. So that in that sense, until we decide to operate in that exchange market and fix that rate, we cannot in that sense run out of official reserves. We have to enter that market with official reserves before we can lose them. And if we leave that rate to move freely, that rate will move to the point which is required. So it can then be said that if the export and import competing goods and services are not forthcoming, the exchange rate will move until they are forthcoming. In part, however, this kind of answer begs the question, which, if properly phrased, is concerned not with the possibility, but with the extent of the adjustment in the exchange rate and the economy as a whole which would be required. Now, as far as the invisible items are concerned, they do not provide much source of comfort for those who argue that this shift would be easily accomplished. Canada has traditionally run a deficit on invisible account. As would be expected from Canada's international investment position, there has for some time been a significant deficit in interest and dividends. This deficit totaled as much as $200 million in the late 20s, a much larger sum in relation to the size of total trade and the economy as a whole than the $500 million deficit today. Freight and shipping has also tended to be a deficit account, and at just under $100 million today, it's proportionally only slightly larger than the $20 to $30 million deficit of the late 20s. Tourist and travel expenditure, on the other hand, has traditionally been a credit item, but in the last few years this has been reversed, and surpluses which used to run as high as $80 to $90 million in the late 20s, and under exchange restrictions in 1948 and 49 as high as $145 million, have become deficits of over $200 million in 1959 and 60. The $345 million reversal between 1948 and 59 results from a $460 million increase in Canadian expenditures abroad and a $115 million increase in foreign expenditures in Canada. Around $250 million of this reversal of $350, that is, from a surplus item to a deficit item, around $250 million of the reversal occurred in transactions between Canada and the United States in tourist and travel expenditure. Gold production for export has remained fairly stable between 140 million and 165 million over the last 10 years. Finally, there's a miscellaneous category of all other items, which includes inheritance and immigrants funds, some government transactions, miscellaneous income, business services, and other transactions. The deficit in this item has increased by over 300 million in the last 10 years, business services being a very important part of that deficit. In the case of tourist and travel expenditure, the exchange rate has undoubtedly played some part in influencing the size of the deficit. This is also true to a limited extent of other invisible items. It may well be true, however, that if the capital flow were significantly reduced, more dramatic changes would take place in merchandise trade than in non-merchandise transactions. It might appear that the question of what happens if there is a curtailment of the capital flow is an academic one, but this may not turn out to be the case. In recent years, there have been literally hundreds of speeches deploring the size of the capital flow and its effect on the ownership and control of Canadian industry. This, in turn, has given birth to some relatively mild legislative changes, but there are many who would welcome more vigorous action. For example, the position of the Governor of the Bank of Canada is well known and was restated in New York in the following terms, and I quote, "Leaving aside the seriously underdeveloped countries, self-development is better for the rounded life and continued vigor of a nation like Canada, and will do more to satisfy national aspirations of every kind than the most ideal kind of purely economic development if the latter involves perpetuation of large deficits in our balance of payments, continued reliance on endlessly growing foreign debt, and a continuously shrinking area of industry under domestic ownership and control." Now, this view is not lacking in support from a variety of sources, and it may well be that as a result of the development of this view, that Canada could be faced with a sharply curtailed capital inflow. Now, the recession has added greatly to the army of critics of the capital inflow. Indeed, the number of those who feel that all of the recent inflow of capital has had a desirable effect on the Canadian economy, in the last two or three years has probably shrunk to a corporal's guard. The explanation is simple. In a year such as 1956, when the resources of the economy were being strained to the limit, additional increments of foreign capital added directly to the total capital put in place. The appreciation of the exchange rate in 1956 had the desirable effect of restraining exports and encouraging imports in a year when this economy was strained up to the limit. In the recent years of economic slack, however, this has not been the case for more than a part of the capital inflow. Direct investment in new plant and equipment leads to additional investment as well as to a current account deficit. So in that sense, we gain on the swings what we lose on the roundabouts. Direct investment, which merely involves taking over an existing Canadian installation, may have only a limited effect on investment. Finally, the provision of capital to provinces, municipalities, and other portfolio borrowers provides from an external source finance which can be made available domestically without placing any strain on the available resources. Thus, during the recent period of slack, when a significantly appreciated exchange rate was a curse and not a blessing, many Canadians lost enthusiasm for much of the large inflow of capital which helped to maintain that rate. It has been argued that the unwanted portion of the flow of capital cannot be blamed entirely upon the Canadian borrower or on the American lender, but rather upon the general state of the capital market and the level of the rate of interest in this country. And this helped, indeed, to create conditions under which you might say that water had flowed into a jar which was already overflowing. Several people have come forward with alternative suggestions. It has, for example, been put forward that we should have entered the government should have entered the exchange market directly and manipulated our foreign exchange rate to the point where we would to devalue our exchange rate and permit us to derive the encouragement from a devalued exchange rate to our exports and the discouragement to our imports. There is a sense in which there was nothing to prevent us from doing this. We needed to remember, however, that our free exchange rate is in effect allowed to us by other countries. We are permitted to have a flexible exchange rate in defiance of our formal obligations under the International Monetary Fund, which require us to fix an exchange rate and maintain that rate. We are permitted to keep this flexible exchange rate really because we leave it flexible, because we do not attempt to manipulate it. If we had entered the exchange market directly and attempted to manipulate our exchange rate as a device for helping us out of our current unemployment situation, then it would have been fair for other countries to charge that we were using our flexible exchange rate to get a competitive advantage at their expense and to call upon us to honor our obligations under the International Monetary Fund and accept a fixed exchange rate. This business of the flexible exchange rate makes some issues a good deal more complicated. For example, it's frequently said that this country has priced itself out of world markets. And that is a very easy thing to do if you have a fixed exchange rate. For if you are locked in, if you like, to the price structures of other countries, then if your prices rise and theirs do not rise, there is a direct sense in which you price yourself out of world markets. It's a more difficult feat to accomplish with a flexible exchange rate. It is always possible for one industry to get out of line with the existing exchange rate and have too high a price to match its foreign competitors. It's even possible for a whole region to get out of step with the rest of the country and price itself out of world markets. It's more difficult for the country as a whole to price itself out of world markets, for if prices rise, unless there are some influences coming to bear through the capital market, then the tendency will be that this will be reflected in the exchange rate, and thus an increase in prices will, unless there are other factors at work in the capital market, lead to a weakening in the exchange rate, which will correct the original price movement. That's when we talk about being priced out of the world market, when we have a flexible exchange rate, we have to talk about it with a good deal of caution, and limit ourselves to particular industries, particular regions, and particular situations in which this can be argued clearly. Well, let me sum up the few remarks that I've made. I see that I have left you, in a sense, without very many answers to the questions that I originally posed. What, for example, of the American balance of payments problem? Will it be an obstacle to President Kennedy's plan for domestic economic expansion, and by doing so make our short-term prospects less favorable? That question cannot be answered with a straight yes or no, but so far the American administration appear to be fairly optimistic that there will be no basic conflict between their domestic objectives and their international objectives. Now, what of our balance of payments problem? Our problem is really not a payments problem, but rather a capital inflow problem. For some, the capital inflow is too large in good years and bad, since it leads to too great a level of foreign ownership and control of Canadian industry. To others, who are quite prepared to see a large-scale inflow in years of prosperity, some of the inflow and the resulting part of the current account deficit in the last 3 or 4 years is regarded as having had a depressing effect on this economy. Almost everyone would agree, however, that this has only been a part of our unemployment problem. And then what shall we say of the European trade arrangements? We were not able to give a clear answer to that question. Will these arrangements have an adverse effect on our trade? On the face of it, things do not look too promising. But it's too early to tell until we find out how we've fared in these Geneva negotiations. And even then, there are too many imponderables on the possible effects to European economic growth to provide any certain answers. But what if the 7 join the 6 on something close to the 6's terms? That is a more serious matter, and it's not easy to see how such an arrangement can be negotiated without some threat to our trade. Speaking more broadly, however, those of us who are affected with the traditional economist bias in favor of freer trade have welcomed the way in which these arrangements have shaken up the whole world tariff situation and provided the opportunity for far-reaching changes. So far, we have not responded, but it is not too late, and we may still play a significant part in promoting the development of freer multilateral trade.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Young has agreed to answer some questions, and I'm pleased to take them now.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Young just said it's too early to tell.
Could I hear the question, please?
The speaker has just said it's too early to tell exactly what the possible effect or possible adverse effect of the European trading area may be. Now, my question is, can we afford to wait and see if it has an adverse effect? Or is there anything we could, should Canada take some precautionary measures? And if so, what precautionary measures could Canada take to offset a possible adverse effect?
Of the common European market. Mm-hmm.
Well, at the very least, even if we do nothing positive, there's no doubt that we are going to bargain very hard. We and other outside countries have a good deal of economic strength from this point of view. We are large markets for the products of the 6 and the 7, and in large measure they will have to pay due regard to our position in any event. So that, at the very worst, we are not going to necessarily be led down the road to ruin. On the other hand, some of us take just the opposite view. When we were worried about the problems of future world tariff arrangements in 1954 and 1955, before any of this happened, The world looked like a very solid, rigid kind of place. There were still a number of restrictions on European trade. European currencies were non-convertible. There appeared to be very shadowy prospects for any forward movement. We and the Americans and other countries had been members of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and in the early years, we had carried forward important changes of our tariff arrangements under the GATT. John Deutsch, who was my predecessor here, played an important part in those events. But from 1950 on, this thing had run out of steam. The GATT was not moving forward in any significant way. And as you looked about the world, it seemed there was a very little prospect of anything dramatic happening for some time. Well, when the 6th and the 7th entered the picture, then to many of us, this looked like an opportunity. They were bringing together many of the major trading countries of the world and blandly announcing their willingness to go free with each other. This was unheard of. Two or three years before, people had said only fools talk about free trade. All one can say is there is some slight possibility of marginal reduction. So this shook up the whole of the world picture. The fact that there was a six forced the British and the other OEC countries to take account of the necessity of accommodation, and they began to be prepared to offer initiatives. When I was writing a book on this subject, I had written a little part of that, of one chapter, on the possibility of a free trade area between the United Kingdom and Canada as a theoretical possibility, as a first step to a wider arrangement, and was prevailed upon to remove it from the book on the grounds that this was an outright impossibility, that this was just a ridiculous thing to include. And mind you, we'd hardly got the book into proof, so that it couldn't be changed, and the British were on our doorstep. So the thing really shook up the whole of world trading arrangements. Now, for some of us, that seemed to be an opportunity to try and move forward, and particularly an opportunity for this country, because it was very important for this country, once this opportunity had been given to it, at least it seemed to some of us, to try and search for a wider arrangement within which we would feel more comfortable than in any bilateral arrangement, and which would be a better alternative to pulling back within ourselves. And that's why some of us felt that when the British overture did come, that while it was quite unattractive to us as a finished arrangement, that it was a possibility worth examination. And that's why some of us had felt at each stage in this, every time that this thing has come up again, that we should have been pressing hard for some accommodation between this continent and Europe and going beyond. Indeed, there's really, I don't think, any basic difference between those who argue for the two routes. You hear some people say, let's have a North Atlantic free trade area. It's not always clear just what they mean by that. If they meant by that, let's have an accommodation which is restricted to North America and Europe, one could take the view that this might be quite unfortunate from the point of view of the total world. This would include within it virtually all the wealthy countries of the world and exclude the underdeveloped countries, Australia, Japan, and some other advanced countries outside. So that if that were in itself, which has been an idea that the Swedes and others have put forward, that in itself is not a particularly attractive alternative. If, however, we think of the North Atlantic free trade area in a much wider sense, that is, as a technique for bringing together this continent and Europe, and simultaneously being prepared to extend the benefits of such an association reciprocally to other advanced countries who have to be expected to buy their way in, and unilaterally to underdeveloped countries because they can't possibly be excluded and have this a reasonable arrangement, then this combination is very much the same as the combination one gets by working through the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade to whittle down the outside tariffs of Europe and whittle down the tariffs of the rest of the world through a general multilateral approach. In other words, you can drive the wedge in at either place wherever it seems that the going will be easiest. But the ultimate end of the whole operation is unquestionably some kind of trading arrangement which would necessarily involve the United States and other advanced countries and which would coordinate the trading policies of the entire West and East and the rest and anyone who was prepared to join.
Isn't the increase in the unfavorable
our unfavorable trade balance in physical trade and the increase of the inflow of capital from the United States, isn't that a very unfavorable long-term prospect for this country?
Perhaps I might ask.
Fine. The situation as far as our trade was concerned would tend to righten itself.
Yes.
Wouldn't it?
Yes.
But if, on the other hand, wouldn't that very situation tend to increase the flow of capital into this country? Wouldn't it be American investors would have that much better opportunity for investing in this country if our exchange rate was down? So our inflow of capital would increase, our trade situation might improve, but our inflow of capital would increase, and I can't see where we're going to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. We economists don't really deserve to tell people what's going to happen to the capital inflow, because I think we were all surprised by this capital inflow we had. You know, that after the war, we thought we were going to be a capital exporting country. And we lent very heavily abroad, in fact, got into balance of payments troubles because we lent so much that we couldn't make good on it when we had our own domestic expansion. So in a sense, this long-term capital inflow was rather unexpected. It was in response to understandable pressures that we were an expanding, prosperous economy with newly discovered resources, and this provided a great opportunity for foreign investors, and they came pouring in. But we were caught, if you like, unawares by this, and it was in a sense it upset a rather subtle equilibrium on the political side. We had sort of over the years had some sort of saw-off on this issue of how closely we wanted to integrate our economy with that of the United States and how far we wanted to maintain a certain amount of distinctness. And we had some sort of balance had been achieved on that subject. And this subtle balance was pretty well upset by this flow of capital, because that was a flow of factors of production rather than goods, but it had the same tendency to lead to closer linkage in the two economies. So in a sense, it was unexpected and to many people upsetting because of the integration consequences of it, which is one. And if that concerns you, then one could be concerned, as many people were 5 years ago and now and any time, that one does not want the capital inflow because it's foreign. See, that my own feeling on this subject is that sometimes some of the analyses of the consequences of foreign capital inflow have missed the boat, in a sense. When we were on the Gordon Commission, we had a whole book written on this subject. And what the authors of that book were trying to do is to analyze the behavior of American firms and analyze the behavior of international trade unions to discover whether that international element affected their behavior, damaged our exports, or led to too little employment of Canadian executives, or what have you. And what happened was that they chased all these particular criticisms to earth to try and test them, and then they found there was not enough difference in the behavior of American subsidiaries and Canadian firms to justify really strongly felt emotions on this particular topic, that these acted sufficiently close to one another that there wasn't really anything to argue about. But it may be that all that sort of thing misses the boat. That if the ultimate question simply is, long-term capital inflow may add to the capital resources of our economy, and in good years it does, and in bad years some of it may not. But if it adds to the capital in this economy, that will tend to generate more economic growth in this country, and from that point of view, it's good. On the other hand, it leads to more ownership and control and presence of foreign capital in this country, and to many people, that is bad. And somehow you have to make a balance. You have to decide where you sit on that particular issue and just how far you're prepared to go in acting to curtail it and how far you're not. And the essence of that one is, how much benefit do you forego if you do? And that, oddly enough, is not a question which has been analyzed very carefully by people who've looked at this problem, and yet that's the central question. The real issue isn't so much behavior, because every behavioral study seems to yield very little fruit. The real essence of the situation is how much economic growth or economic gain do you forego if you don't have this capital? And how much does it cost you to forego it? Then if you knew how much it cost you to forego it, you could decide whether you wanted to pay the price. And of course, we don't want foreign capital in this country. We don't have to have it. Many people have had exaggerated views, it's true, of how sensitive foreign investment will be to legislative changes. Some people argued before the baby budget that particular twist of the screw would have quite an effect on foreign investment. It turned out, however, that this country is so highly regarded as a place to put one's capital that a minor legislative change of that kind did not really move us very far down the list of desirable places to put capital. We're still right up at the top, and the capital keeps coming in. And in spite of the fact that we've had a good deal of slack in the economy and not very promising prospects over the last 2 or 3 years, still the investors come in anticipation of future gains. But now we can go on like that. There's no reason that we can go on, if you like, indefinitely. If one doesn't have any views at all about the foreign ownership side, one just says, let the capital come, I don't care, I want all the economic growth the country can have, then in a sense, there's nothing to worry about. The system will take care of this. The capital will flow in. On the other hand, if you don't want it for political reasons, you just don't think it ought to be here, then one can stop it. And after all, there's a great debate in this country, really, on just this issue. And not many people are found on the two extremes. There's a difference of emphasis, how much you're going to give up. And one of the things that debate lacks is a good analysis, and which is virtually impossible to do, but even good educated speculation on the subject of how much there is in it for us to have this capital and how much we forego if we give it up. And that, it seems to me, is the real issue.
Dean Curtis.
Picking up the point Professor Young has made, that we very likely, with the British, made a mistake in 54, 55 by hoping that the talk of the common market would disappear if we ignored it long enough, it would just go away. But that now we should re-examine our position and respond in some way to it. Now, my question to Professor Young is this. Can he see any accommodation by the common market system with the Commonwealth preference system? Do you think it can be bridged?
Yes, I think that it's going to be very complicated, but this is I think the thing that's first on the agenda now is some very complicated arrangement whereby our position in the British market will be protected in much the sense it is now, in that other people will get the benefits that we've got, but there will be not very much of the reverse side of that. That is, in fact, the item that is on the agenda now and being currently discussed, I think, is a rather complicated system of accommodation which will preserve what preferences can be preserved within this kind of wider system. It's going to be a pretty complicated kind of package. And the question for us, of course, always was that it just didn't seem to make sense to many people for us to talk to the Europeans unless the Americans were going to talk to the Europeans with us. You know, it just didn't figure that we should play a part in this thing, and we ought to just wait around. Well, the Americans were prepared to wait on this one. They had pushed the common market themselves and were anxious to see it get established and so on. It's only after it's safely established and the thing has begun to move underway that the United States position is subtly changing towards this, and they're thinking of themselves more of as an outside country rather than as the friend and protector and the originator, really, of the common market. So we, in a sense, there were many people in this country didn't feel there was any sense in this country doing anything on its own with the Europeans. On the other hand, my own feeling has been that if we had been a little more adventurous in this, that we might have stimulated some second thoughts in the United States in this interval. And my own feeling is that while at various stages some of us has felt that we've come to a turning of the road, it's going to be harder to do something a little later, it may still be that there's still time for us to play a part in this thing, and one important part of that, our avenue to Europe will of course be the British. It's inconceivable that we'd deal with the common market or with anyone else except through the British, so it's bound to have some elements of that preferential system in it, because they will be the people with whom we'll be discussing these matters. Yes, sir.
Chairman, Dr. Young, do you feel that, Dr. Young, that the suggested alignment with the new Argentine-led South American trade grouping might have some value in terms of Canadian economic growth and prosperity? In view of the fact that they're so inflation-ridden and politically unstable and so on?
Yes, it's not an arrangement which occurs at all naturally to anyone in this country, I think. It's just they are very minor trading partners of ours, they just don't really figure very early on the agenda of an arrangement. You know, there's some young people out in this province, I think, who at one stage suggested, and I remember in a joke on one occasion when I was in Ottawa, a senior bureaucrat said, you're a fellow who's pretty enthusiastic about free trade areas. If you want to have the free trade area, that will give the greatest economic benefit in the sense that the initial price structures of the two countries differ most, then a bilateral free trade area between Canada and Japan is the one that makes sense. But the difficulty is that not only would that lead to a certain amount of rather radical accommodation rather quickly in some parts of the country, but there are sort of directions in which one moves on that, and that doesn't figure to be a very high device on the agenda for making a wider trade arrangement, I don't think.
Take one more question. Yes, sir.
Anybody else want to
Yes. Well, we take both of them. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, wonder if I could take a minute or two to explain the background of the question. Professor Young has given us considerable detail in the balance of payments, the balance of trade, and the rate of exchange. Very complicated matters that are likely to seem to us to be more the concern of the experts in Ottawa than to be a local situation. Yet, if we think about the elements that are there, we can see that they are our own exports, our own in British Columbia imports, and our own recent capital imports that he's talking about. And the unemployment in British Columbia is indeed the worst unemployment situation in Canada, barring that of the chronic nature in the Maritimes. And if we who are suffering from the situation which he outlined, that is that the capital imports, which have been responsible for keeping some of our people so busy until a year or so ago, are the very ones which have set the rate of exchange against us and, as it were, taken from us with one hand what has been given on the other. Now, it seemed to me that at one stage, Professor Young suggested that he could see a way out of this. He mentioned three kinds of capital imports, the purchase of foreigners undertaking new investments in Canada, foreigners buying old investments in Canada, and foreigners buying Canadian municipal securities and provincial securities. And as to this last one, that is foreigners buying Canadian provincial and municipal securities, he seemed to me to suggest that the savings was already here in Canada and that it might be possible to divert Canadian municipal and provincial lending from foreign markets to Canadian markets and thus to get ourselves out of the vicious circle which you'd heard earlier been describing. If that wasn't indeed his suggestion, I wish that he could perhaps expand a little bit more. Would he think, for example, that some legislation would be useful which would stop provincial and municipal forum abroad.
Always good to get, it's always good to get a question from a colleague on staff, Dr. Young.
A friendly colleague. Yes, there are several. One possibility that has been suggested, the one that I think I mentioned, the sort of obvious thing that occurs to many people, and it may not necessarily be the correct thing, but the obvious thing is to suggest that the structure of interest rates in a country which is importing this kind of capital, when it has unemployed resources, must be due to some breakdown in this capital market process, and that steps ought to be taken to deal with the whole range of interest rates. The governor of the bank has put forward in his annual report this year the view that this is a pretty small share of the total capital expenditure in this country, and that's true, and that it would be inappropriate to turn the whole structure of the country's interest rates, to alter that whole structure, reduce that structure in order to take account of this particular portion. And he argues that this is the portion, that it is only this portion that he can talk about, because the direct investment that flows in is fairly independent of the interest rate. And that is also true. So that if one says, and this type of capital inflow, one should point out, did dry up in a good part of 56, in 60, a good part of it was located in 58, 59, and just running into the beginning part of this year. So that in any sense, sometimes one might feel that you're locking the stable after the horse is gone anyway at this stage. But if it is true, if one is going to say we won't use the interest rate structure to influence our borrowing, but we'll do something direct, then there's a variety of techniques, I think, that one can use. You can attempt to get some exchange stabilization legislation through of some kind, which will make it illegal for governments to borrow. This is a hazardous thing to do in this country, and doesn't seem to be likely to happen. One can subsidize directly the borrowing of particular junior governments by in effect bridging the gap between the price that they have to pay in New York and the price that they'd have to pay in Canada. Be a difficult calculation to make, be a difficult thing to do, but it could be done. A very interesting suggestion has been put forward by Dean Perry. That is that an attempt should be made to form an investment bank in Canada, which run by the federal government, which would provide to the provinces a source of capital at highly competitive rates, because they would reflect in part the borrowing rates of the federal government. This is an interesting idea, and one that would be well worthy of examination. What it would in effect do would be to in effect split our market to some extent and allow junior governments access to the capital market on more favorable terms than they would enjoy from the existing capital market. It has the same kind of splitting of the market aspect as one of Kennedy's proposals in the United States, which attempted to split the short-term market in the United States and allow foreign governments and central banks to have a higher rate of interest than that prevailing in the market. Well, this would be just the reverse of this, a lower rate of interest than that prevailed in the market, in order to divert the borrowing of provinces from outside to a domestic source. So that there's a variety of ways in which it could be done, all of them in a sense requiring, in effect, attempting to supplement the operations of the capital market, and all of them in effect accepting that it is undesirable to move the entire interest rate structure to take account of this. And this, of course, is, as everyone knows, has been a subject of a very hot controversy in this subject, in this country. So the United States is torn between this problem of wanting to get the interest rate down domestically in order to stimulate expansion in the country, and then being afraid of the withdrawal of capital abroad. So there's been a real pulling and hauling, if you like, of, of economic objectives domestically and internationally. A low rate of interest wanted for the inside job and a high rate of interest wanted for the outside job. Now, Canada, you see, in effect, has been in a more favorable position in that we want, that many people argue in any event, that we want a low rate of interest for both jobs. It's stimulating domestically and will help our international situation. But this is not a view that has been widely shared, or at least not in the more important places. And therefore, we haven't had that particular result.
I didn't think, Professor Scott, that you would get him any closer to Mr. Coyne than that. Take the last question, sir.
I think it's a simple question. I don't know whether the answer is simple. Is Canada sufficiently in the big league so far as the economic situation is concerned to be able to take an initiative in regard to our position economically and in world trade? Or do we of necessity have to wait and see what certain other powers do first?
Yes, I think that there are times when we do that. There are times when we just happen to be in a position where we can tip the balance, which is just on the balance, where we can push things one way or the other if we happen to catch them. But a few months ago, if someone said, what should we do? The obvious answer to that was, let's wait and see what President Kennedy's going to do. And then if he's not going to do anything, then let's think about whether in our interest we want to do something independently. Let's see if he's going to do anything. Let's talk to him about what we think he ought to do. And then if he's not going to do anything, it's quite possible that he has been remarkably reticent on this general subject. It may be that we will then we have to think our own through our own situation. And it's true that if the situation is not right, why our weight is quite small. We should always remember though that we're bigger people in trade than we are in say military affairs or what have you. We're a big trader, and so that we're not a country that people can take lightly anytime. We're not really big. When we're facing an irrigation like the six, it's very important to have for us in arguing, say, about the six's agricultural policy, to have the Australians and the Americans and others with us because we can't threaten enough. We're not a recipient of enough exports from the six to really bulldoze them. But we're not insignificant, and if we got any friends acting with us, we're a significant market for a lot of countries, and they can't treat us too lightly.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to ask Dean Chant to thank our speaker this evening.
Mr. Chairman, very pleased to thank Dr. Young for his remarks this evening. I think probably more than any speaker we've had, he has paid us the compliment of plunging in depth, if I might describe it that way. A very intricate, shifting, and often bewildering field to many of us, this field of international trade and exchange. We appreciate that he's undertaken to deal with that also in an interpretive way, rather than in a strictly descriptive manner. And I'm sure we all agree that he has cleared up for many of us, at least some of the intricate facets of this very difficult and complex problem. And on behalf of this audience, I wish to thank you very much for your address this evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the end of another year of this Institute series, and ordinarily we'd be closing shop for the year, but we've been very fortunate to have an extra dividend or a bonus for our last lecture, and I'd like to draw to your attention that this lecture will not be on a Saturday night. Because of the Easter weekend, we decided to ask our speaker to address us on this coming Wednesday night. That is on March the 29th in the University Auditorium. And the speaker will be, as you know, Sir Charles Darwin, and he will speak to us on the subject, the explosion of world population. Sir Charles, as you know, is a distinguished relative of Charles Darwin, and he is a mathematical physicist who is on visit at the University of California and who has kindly consented to come here to complete his lecture series. I would ask you, therefore, to attend our last lecture at the University Auditorium at 8:15 next Saturday night. Thank you. Wednesday. There's one more thing just occurs to me. Mr. Sager wanted me to remind you that we will take the opportunity to assist the next year's executive compiling a list of people who should receive the first announcement of the lectures for 1962-63. And to assist the incoming president and the executive, we will therefore arrange for 4 or 5 girls to be seated in the auditorium on Wednesday night, at which time, if you would be kind enough to renew your membership, which would make it possible for you to get the notices ahead of anyone else. Thank you very much.